President Raisi says Iranian armed forces will target code the center of the Zionist regime if it makes the slightest move against the Islamic Republic. Israeli tanks and armored vehicles make an incursion into northern Gaza's Strip amid recent tensions in the occupied West Bank. And Russia launches multiple airstrikes on Ukraine's western and southern regions amid intense fighting for control over the strategic port city of Mariupol. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The Iranian army has held a miniature parade to mark the National Army Day. The parade, held annually on April 18th, featured the latest indigenously produced miniature hardware. Addressing the event, President Ibrahim Raisi said that the Iranian armed forces will target the center of the Zionist regime if it makes the slightest move against Tehran. Yusuf Jalali has more from the venue of the parades in Tehran.
Heavy stumps of marching soldiers and convoys of Iranian-made weapons paraded in Tehran and across the country on the National Army Day. All of the four branches of the military took part in the key parade, held at the presence of army officials and Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi. Addressing the ceremony, the president hailed the army's achievements despite the U.S. sanctions.
The defense industry fared the best amid the sanctions atmosphere. The Islamic Republic's army achieved significant capabilities during this period. Not only did the army defend the nation during the Iraq-imposed war on Iran, but it has stood with the people and for the people in all areas.
The parade featured the latest military achievements and weapons produced by the Iranian army, including radars, tanks, armored vehicles, drones, fighter jets, and missiles. This year's highlights were FAT-360 surface-to-surface missile, Labeg precision strike rockets, and Dezful and Majid air defense systems. The Islamic Republic says it produces over 80% of its needed military hardware indigenously. In his address to the parade, the Iranian president said the country's show of power sends messages both to friends and enemies.
The preparedness of the army sends the message of hope to the friends of the Islamic Republic. There's also a message to the enemy. The enemy must know that the military might of our armed forces gives us a deterrent power. They must know that the smallest move made against our country and our nation would be monitored by the sharp eyes of our armed forces.
The National Army Day was designated in 1980, following a historic speech by late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. There, he thanked the army for its role in the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution by announcing neutrality in the conflict between the former Pahlavi regime and the revolutionaries.
4 decades of arms embargoes have denied Iran access to even a bullet from other countries. The army says the parades today show that those bans have not harmed Iran's military capability. But in fact, they've been a blessing, since they prompted Iran to build up its own military arsenal so that its security is no longer tied to foreign arms. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iranian Foreign Ministry has again stressed that those complicit in the assassination of top military figure General Soleimani will not go unpunished. Spokesman Said Khatibzadeh made the announcement during his weekly presser. He said perpetrators behind the general's assassination will be brought to justice. As regards the Vienna talks on the restoration of the 2015 deal, he said there will be no agreement unless there is a general agreement. Khatibzadeh said the deal will not be subjected to any changes. He slammed Washington's efforts to interfere in issues related to Iran, saying that the behavior of the U.S. in practice is different from what its officials claim. Foreign Ministry spokesman noted that the release of Iran's frozen assets is not related to any third party. He stressed that Tehran acts according to the interests of its people. Well, reports have it that Israeli forces have entered Beit Hanun, the besieged Palestinian territory of the Gaza Strip. We've talked to our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon for an update on the Israeli incursion.
Israeli tanks and armored caterpillar D9 bulldozers made an incursion into the eastern part of the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun area today. They raised the agricultural land in the area and they fired some shots towards the farmers in the area. This is according to people who live in the area and eyewitnesses in Beth Hanun. This recent Israeli incursion into Gaza comes amid the ongoing attacks against Palestinians, especially in Al-Quds. Some people here believe that this is a part of an Israeli provocation towards the Palestinian resistance, possibly trying to have them react to what's happening in Al-Quds and also in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. Israeli tanks and bulldozers haven't made such incursions for weeks now.
The Tel Aviv regime is escalating its crackdown on the West Bank as tensions are running high across the occupied territories following violent attacks on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli forces shot two more Palestinians during their raids in the West Bank town of Al-Khalil. Regime forces also attacked Palestinians in the Silwan neighborhood of Al-Quds. They earlier injured some 20 more Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured or detained since Friday after troops stormed the mosque and violently attacked the worshippers there. Hamas resistance movement has condemned the raids, describing Al-Aqsa as its red line. Palestinians view the vicious raids and desecration of Islam's third holiest site as a major provocation. They're calling for international intervention to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Ukraine says multiple blasts have rocked its western and southern cities as Russia is pushing its military campaign to take control of eastern cities. Authorities in Lviv say a series of Russian raids on military infrastructure left six people dead and ignited blazes. Media also spoke of blasts in the capital, Kiev, though details are sketchy. Meantime, Ukrainian presence says the shelling in the northeastern city of Kharkiv has killed 18 people and wounded some 100 people in the past 4 days. Officials also say the fighting rages in the southeastern port city of Mariupol. They say parts of the city are under their control. Russia says it has taken over all urban areas of the city, which gives it land access to Crimea that joined Russia in 2014. French presidential election has roared back to relevance as voters are upset over the inflation crisis. Many are happy with the austerity policies of President Macron, though others are skeptical of his contender Marine Le Pen's promises too. From Paris, Rami Mazzaheta reports.
The French presidential election was trending as an easy victory for the incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, until the unrest in Ukraine began. Macron's insistence on long-term sanctions for Russia exploded already high inflation. That's resulted in widespread hardship, resentment, and tough assessments of Macron's economic record.
It's clear that Macron has not improved the quality of life for the French. He's not responsible for all the problems he's had to deal with, but it's clear there's a big difference between what he's promised and what he's delivered.
The French election may come down to this. Who do voters feel will protect the average person from the economically explosive effect of long-term sanctions on Russia over the unrest in the Ukraine? It's not a question the mainstream media wants to discuss, but it is top of mind for the average person. Polls show the race is now a dead heat, with a soaring Marine Le Pen of the National Rally taking an opposite tack, promising to oppose Russia energy sanctions, which are wreaking havoc with gas, heating, and food prices. As the challenger, Le Pen doesn't have a record to defend, and she's escaping anger over the economic crisis.
Macron has absolutely not done a good job on protecting our purchasing power. The middle class feels that Macron has contempt for the middle class, and they also feel a great contempt for the neoliberal globalist banker Macron.
Macron's far-right economic policies provoked the unprecedented yellow vest protests in 2018. He only made minor concessions before turning to brutal repression, and the coronavirus crisis only aggravated economic inequalities.
Macron needed to go much further in his efforts to reduce prices. It's unbearable to go to the supermarket these days. Even people who make an honest salary say that they are having trouble.
Abstention may reach record highs because many voters wonder if Le Pen would actually deliver on her populist economic promises. Her party has historically been aligned with neoliberalism as well. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The The United States is once again the scene of protests against deadly violence, police violence again, targeting racial minorities, this time in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And that's where a black Congolese refugee was fatally shot at the hands of a white police officer early this month. We've taken a closer look at the issue in our news review program.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, public outrage continues to swell in the U.S. City of Grand Rapids over the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer, with demonstrators turning out for the fifth consecutive day. The protests remain peaceful, with the demonstrators chanting slogans and waving signs. They've been calling for justice for Patrick Loyoya. The 26-year-old Congolese refugee was killed during a routine traffic stop earlier this month during a scuffle with an officer over a taser in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The officer has not been charged. The victim's family is demanding that authorities dismiss the officer and file criminal charges against him. The Democratic Republic of the Congo has also condemned the assassination of its citizen, calling it a cowardly act. Loyoya is the latest in a growing list of racial minorities killed at the hands of police. One such high-profile case involved the killing of George Floyd, which ignited widespread protests against racism in the U.S. and across the globe. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Colin Campbell, joining us live from Washington, D.C., and also from Detroit. We have with us Abayumi as a Kiwi journalist and writer. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Let's begin with Colin. Now, after what happened with George Floyd, and we saw protests not only across the U.S., interestingly, across the world, a piece of legislation was supposed to pass in order to restrict this type of police violence against people that they plan to arrest. That piece of legislation was blocked. Tell us more about that and the reason behind that, because the same thing has happened again. And if we look at that piece of legislation, we realize that if it had been passed, we wouldn't be witnessing such scenes.
Yeah, that piece of legislation has been blocked by those who don't have the political will to see changes happening in America. For many of us, this is a dire need for there to be policy change. For others, it's just not as important. And what they're looking at, those who rejected the bill, said that there were too many stipulations that inhibit police's capabilities of carrying out their jobs. However, those who really know how to do policing in a more adept way can indicate that policing would not be hampered, but instead the lives of citizens would be more protected. One of those issues is circles around in a phrase called qualified immunity, and this protects police. Qualified immunity protects police from being sued in civil lawsuits should they be known or argued or proven to be negligent when making an arrest, especially when it results in a fatality like it did with Loyola. And so this is a problem that is being caused by trying to advance any further pieces of legislation that would really protect citizens from police aggression, from police brutality, and of course, fatal shootings, unnecessary fatal shootings. And as we know, Loyola was unarmed when he was killed, as so many black men are in America when they are killed by police.
Now, Mr. Azakiwi, if you could please elaborate more on the situation right now, and can we expect any meaningful action from the part of the police in order to hold that police officer accountable?
Thank you. And I'm in the city of Detroit, which is about an hour and a half from Grand Rapids. Historically, Grand Rapids has had problems with police violence against civilians, particularly African Americans. There was a rebellion there in the summer of 2020. During the whole period of the George Floyd rebellion, which went across the country and indeed worldwide. It depends on the reaction on the part of the people. People have mobilized across the state to go to Grand Rapids to ensure that justice be done. This young man, 26 years old, who came to the United States probably as a result of the instability in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which the United States is largely responsible for, going all the way back at least until 1960 and 1961, when they overthrew Patrice Lumumba, assassinated him, and installed a puppet counter-revolutionary regime. In the United States, you're a black man. It doesn't matter whether or not you were born in the Caribbean, whether you were born in Africa, Central America, Europe, or whatever. They're viewing you as the same, irrespective of your national origin. This was totally unnecessary. They already had the vehicle stopped. He did not comply according to them. However, the question is, what was the attitude of the white police officer? Anyone who was stopped, whether they're police officers or non-law enforcement personnel, you can sense that your life is in danger. This young man sensed that his life was in danger. And when your life is in danger, you're going to resist either by fighting back or by fleeing. And this is what he was attempting to do. And he was correct. His life was under threat. And he got a bullet to the back of the head, being unarmed and posing no threat whatsoever to the police. They already had the vehicle. They could have allowed him to leave the scene, and he still would have been tracked down by law enforcement inevitably. So this just goes to show the vicious character of the United States racist system and the failure of the U.S. Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act is going to blow up in their faces in the primary and general elections for the midterms that are coming up later this year.
Thank you very much, Abayomi Azakiwi, journalist and writer out of Detroit, and our correspondent Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your views with us on this edition of the News Review, and thanks to all of you for following this edition.
That's a wrap for this News Bulletin. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
economic divide.
It's an economic crisis of mammoth proportions. Sri Lanka appears to be in a state of economic freefall. Shortage of fuel, medicines, and basic stuff, along with a foreign currency shortage, has led to protests and social disorder. And now the country is looking for another IMF loan. Hi, I'm Kavitah Wai. The Sri Lankan economic crisis, the topic of today's edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, Sri Lanka facing its worst financial crisis in more than 70 years. Food prices have risen by a record 30% in March alone, grappling with Asia's highest rate of inflation, a currency collapse, and fuel shortages. Then, dissatisfaction with the Rajapaksa family, whose members hold several top positions in government. Cabinet of ministers resigned in full, with Sri Lankans protesting, leading to deadly street protests demanding the president's resignation. That's the political crisis of the story. And we will also take a look at the mounting foreign debt. Cash-strapped Sri Lanka has taken short-term loans from India, and China now is looking to the IMF again. Is the Western-backed IMF the source of the economic crisis?
Sri Lanka is in a crisis. Calls from the public and opponents of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to resign. The reason is Sri Lanka's worsening economic situation. People have held demonstrations for weeks over lengthy power cuts and shortages of gas, food, and other basic goods. Nearly all cabinet ministers and scores of parliament members have left the government over public anger.
And I'm here because it's not enough to just reshuffle the cabinet. We want accountability. It's not just resignation that we want. We want people to take accountability for their actions. We want these leaders to take accountability for their actions.
But Sri Lanka's beleaguered president says that he will not be resigning. Opposition MPs have also rejected his invite to form a national unity government. Rajapaksa has lifted controversial state of emergency measures following further protests. The president had invoked the law on April 1 after protests outside of his house. Parliament Speaker has told Parliament there will be acute food shortages and that the economic crisis is just the beginning.
Yes, I am expecting it to get a lot worse, and unfortunately they are unable to contain it because the people who created the crisis are very much still in charge of the economic management. So I think it's behaviorally impossible for them to acknowledge that they have made a huge blunder and they have to reverse all these incorrect economic policy.
The economic meltdown in Sri Lanka spiraled as the Sri Lankan rupee plunged to become the world's worst performing currency. Sovereign dollar bonds dropped to trade at deeply distressed levels, while the stock market fell a further 2%. Over the past few months, Sri Lanka has been facing a dire financial crisis on multiple fronts. People have been suffering power cuts of up to 13 hours, massive inflation, and a shortage of food and basic goods.
The situation in Sri Lanka is dire. It's really spiraling out of control unless urgent action is taken. But what can the government do? Well, in the latest push, it is going to try to tame inflation by raising interest rates. Let's take a look at online viewers and see what they had to say about what is happening in that country. Now, this post shows the depth of the problem. Today, I measure inflation at a stunning 68% for the year. The balance of payments crisis is sinking the Sri Lankan economy. The only way to serve the Sri Lankan rupee and to ease the crisis is to install a currency board. Well, taking a look at this particular post, Sri Lanka's currency plunges to the world's worst performing currency, which has led to an economic meltdown, the rupee shedding a third of its value against the dollar as deepening crisis raises the threat of a default. Next, is the Sri Lankan problem just the tip of the iceberg in South Asia? This viewer has said India on guard as Sri Lanka's economy crumbles. Pakistan faces constitutional crisis, which we saw Imran Khan being ousted, and other neighbors are battling uncertainties. Now, this analysis was a result of a tweet. Sri Lanka's political turmoil risks derailing the economy further. it was worth now taking a look at the analysis, and in this introspective was what we picked out as a highlight. In recent political cycles, economic reform agendas have been promptly reversed by the next government, resulting in policy whiplash and macroeconomic damage. This trend must be reversed. All right, our guest joining us for this edition of the Q&A is Bhavani Fonseca. She's a lawyer and senior researcher at the Center for Policy Alternatives, who joins us from Colombo, Sri Lanka. Bhavani Fonseca, welcome. The economic indicators for Sri Lanka are pretty bad. Inflation, power cuts as a result, protests that are happening, political uncertainty. Tell us how you think this island nation has actually gotten to this point. The government says that it's really a result of COVID-19. Do you buy it?
Thank you, Khalid, for having me on the show. And this is a very unprecedented time in Sri Lanka where we're having a political and economic crisis. It's largely due to the mismanagement and lack of planning from this government. The blame is put on various things, including the pandemic by this government. But it really speaks to not having proper plans, a policy incoherence, and just really inability to address the multiple crises.
All right, we appreciate that. Let's now turn to Professor Mona Haran, who joins us. He's the director of the Center for East Asian Studies at Christ University, joining us from Bangalore. Professor Mona Haran, welcome. Staying afloat economically for Sri Lanka is something that is going to be very difficult. It is in a tight squeeze. It has only a few options. One of them it has decided to go ahead with is subscribing to the IMF and taking a loan from that institution. But it has done so 16 times before. Isn't the situation that it is in now because of loans from institutions like the IMF?
Okay. So I would say, to be fair to IMF, if we look at the IMF loans generally to countries, they are actually not too much of strings attached, unlike you have the bilateral loans that Sri Lanka either borrows from China or some other countries, where in general IMF goes by the special drawing rights, which Sri Lanka has special drawing rights to around 100 million or so. If you stretch it further, they got the loan to the tune of around 700 million or 900 million to the tune of $1 billion. So this comes with low interest rate, and that is preferable.
It's time now for our Info News section. Lots of economic news that we looked at. First, since the IMF is one of the topics of our program, in this piece of news, it shows how it is hard at work. And in this case, it covers Ukraine, another country falling victim to the IMF debt and political cycle. As is evident, the country is war-torn, and the IMF seems to think that it can help it. Now, moving on to the next topic, U.S. recession alarm bells are ringing. Off for that to be something in the works. There's no denying it. This entry has said that the recession shock is coming. Major U.S. bank is issuing that warning. Bank of America went on to say soaring inflation raises the risk of a major economic downturn. And that is not good news for the U.S. that is experiencing record inflation in that country. On to our next piece of news. Poor people are dying earlier. Bad news for the U.K. Britain's class divides based on this are very much alive. Now, according to this, 4 out of 10 male deaths in the most deprived areas are premature. It's worth dwelling on that fact, really. 40% of all male deaths in the most deprived areas are actually avoidable, compared to just 18% in the most affluent regions of the UK. And our final pick covers France. France held the first round of the elections. At this point, it is obvious that there's a tight, not as tight a race between Marine Le Pen and the current or incumbent president, Emmanuel Macron. We're going to take a look at 5 years of Macron and its economy, where, according to the source, has trickled down in drips and drops. That's going to be the topic of our next program. However, we'd like to hear from you for our future programs. If you have a topic that you'd like for us to cover in your part of the world, please send us an email and let us know.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The Sri Lankan economic crisis is one of the most severe cases when it comes to an economy that is faltering, it seems like, in almost every facet, which is what we are going to look at in this in-depth section. First of all, Sri Lanka is trapped in spiraling debt. There's no question about that. When it comes to the top lenders, here they are. You're looking at international sovereign bonds coming in at 36.4%. The Asian Development Bank, ADB, 14.6%. Next up, Japan, 10.9%. And then you have China at 10.8%. But here's the big one. The big one here, as you can see, covers Sri Lanka's foreign debt in terms of the top lenders in this area. That includes institutions like the IMF. And we're going to get into that a little bit more. Let's now focus on the foreign exchange crisis that it's experiencing. Obviously, that is also huge. Its foreign exchange reserves actually saw a drop of 70% in the past 2 years. This is said to be the reason the country is struggling to pay for essential imports. For how could they? The country has only $2 billion in foreign currency reserves, and yet the total debt repayment is $7 billion for the year 2022. That's a huge difference. Now, to give you an idea about how bad the inflation is, here are some prices for everyday goods. Let's take a look at this. It's in their currency, but we're going to focus on the percentage. For rice, 64%, onions, 60%, and then potatoes, 74.8%. That's according to the figures coming from the Central Bank of Sri Lanka. So there you can see just a snapshot of basic items, as we just mentioned there. Now, what happens with economic indicators that are now so bad? In one simple word, chaos. You have fuel supply shortages. That, this is a snapshot again, leads to power cuts, which then impacts manufacturing, and then you have shortages in things like paper, if you can believe that. That's just one example. Think about it. The country has actually ran out of paper. So that's how desperate that country is when it comes to its economic crisis. Now, the basic rules of economics comes into play here, and it's evident. When you have expenditures that are greater than the income of the country, that means that they're borrowing more than they're producing. That's just basic economics. And that is the case with Sri Lanka. Now, you can't ignore what the COVID-19 pandemic actually did to its economy, just like many other nations. For COVID, there were the Easter bombings that cut tourism revenues for the government, and then in turn, they had to use foreign reserves to pay off their debt. In the case of foreign reserves in 2018, it had $6.9 billion, which has now gone down to $2.2 billion for the year 2022. And that's according to an IMF briefing. And then you're looking at the decrease, for example, in GDP for 2020, 3.5% it declined, and the fiscal deficit climbed to 11.1%. And finally, something that many don't know about Sri Lanka and its agriculture industry. It was an initiative that the government set forward in doing. It was an effort to move towards organic farming. The government banned the use of chemical fertilizers because of that bad decision. The steep drop in crop yields was the result of that. And that obviously made the country then become more reliant on foreign imports. And of course, once that happens, one obvious outcome is that foreign reserves will even decrease by more. Now, you have a newly elected finance minister. I mean, really new. He's been in the job for only days now, and This is what he tends to do about the economy, at least one of the steps he's going to take.
Basically, if we can restore the supply chain, if we can provide these necessities on time, we can get our tourism back on track. That will bring dollars in. We need to protect our export industry. We need to protect our supply chain. So if we can do that, I feel if we can, I mean, the numbers are still being worked out. Yeah. I just taken over a day or two ago. But a rough figure is probably we need about $3 billion infusion during the next 3 to 6 month time, from now to 3 to 6 months, for us to meaningfully come out of it.
Okay, $3 to $6 billion is what he said there. All right, let me bring back our guests in order to get a breakdown on this. We have Professor Mona Haran, who's the director of the Center for East Asian Studies at Christ University, who joins us from Bangalore. So, Professor Mona Haran, looking at soaring inflation, you have power cuts, you have different facets of the economy that have broken down, which has led to the protests that we have seen, and there have been deadly protests asking, requesting the government to step down, in which the parliament has actually resigned en masse. What are we looking at when it comes to this economic crisis for Sri Lanka?
Okay, I would say it is not just about COVID-19. There are five other reasons I would point out. Number one, the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war. So if you put together COVID and Ukraine war, of course, COVID is one of the reasons. But if you put Russian-Ukraine war and COVID-19, you would see the rising fuel prices like petroleum and diesel and things like that. And then you have this cooking oil like the cooking oil prices. And then you have fallen tourism, foreign remittances, fallen FDI and so on and so forth because of this, together COVID-19 and Russian-Ukraine war. This is reason number one. Reason number two, the very security situation. Sri Lanka came out of ethnic war in 2009. So economy was slowly coming back. But by then, you had in 2019, April, Easter attacks. Put together again, this impacted Sri Lanka's tourism industry, impact on FDIs and foreign remittances.
All right, very well. Thank you for that. Let's bring in Bhavani Fonseca, lawyer and senior researcher at the Center for Policy Alternatives, who joins us from Colombo, Sri Lanka. Bhavani Fonseca, the IMF is the focus of my question. It's known to give out loans, but then you have political attachments that has been cited based on their track record with countries, but it also creates this cycle of debt. Please explain that to us and why these IMF loans are so controversial, especially when it comes to the case of Sri Lanka, which appears to, again, want to opt for a loan from the IMF.
Well, I mean, this is also a concern that IMF and other financial assistance, loans, raises a lot of issues in terms of sovereignty and what it means to Sri Lanka and Sri Lankans. And this is something we need to really look at because a lot of Sri Lanka's debt is linked to getting into these loan schemes that has got us into this problem.
Sri Lanka has faced a series of problems in recent years which compounded the country's structural issues. In 2018, the country faced a constitutional crisis. The following year, hundreds of people at churches and luxury hotels were killed in the 2019 Easter bombings. And from 2020 onwards, it has been grappling with the COVID-19 pandemic. The crisis has battered the economy, as well as leading to mounting foreign debts, rising inflation, and economic mismanagement by the government. Facing a massive deficit, the government slashed taxes in a doomed attempt to stimulate the economy, but the move backfired, instead hitting government revenue. That prompted rating agencies to downgrade Sri Lanka to near default levels. That meant that the country lost access to overseas markets. The South Asian nation no longer has enough dollar reserves to buy essential items like food, fuel, in order to power vehicles or even generate electricity.
The reason for the shortages is not a shortage of any commodity, but the shortage of dollars. And the shortage of dollars have few reasons. One is the price control on dollar. because that's when you have a price control, it incentivizing importers to import more and discouraging the exporters because they are paying a lower price. Second is, I would say, the excessive money printing or quantitative easing, because when you add more liquid or more money into the system, those money chases behind imports.
To stay afloat and get itself out of the economic quagmire, Sri Lanka has few options outside of turning to the International Monetary Fund, but the island nation has so far received 16 IMF loans since it joined the financial institution in 1950. But the IMF loans come with political attachments. The loans are said to create a cycle of debt that forces the country to just pay that debt. Austere loan conditions reduce economic growth and deepen and prolong financial crises, creating severe hardships for the poorest people in borrowing countries and strengthening local opposition to the IMF.
When it comes to Sri Lanka, it has been the victim of what many don't realize, and that is the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. But what does the IMF have to do with Sri Lanka's economic crisis? Well, let us count the ways. First of all, it is interesting to note that the island nation has so far received 16 IMF loans since it joined the financial institution in 1950. It is now going to go for another loan, which could spell more disaster for the country. But why are IMF loans deemed to be bad? They're supposed to help countries who are in need of money to pay off their debt. But the truth is otherwise. Just listen to what renowned American author John Perkins, best known for his book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, has said about institutions like the World Bank and the IMF.
They buy a very, very cheap debt on these countries, and then they go back to the countries and say, hey, you've got to pay us a lot of money, and we'll litigate against it because we're holding this paper and we're going to go after you. And if you can't pay in cash, then pay in resources or pay in cheap labor markets or whatever. We weren't helping the poor get better lives. We were helping the rich get richer. We were helping the United States colonize a great deal of the world, with U.S. corporations primarily.
There's no shortage of insights into the inner workings of these institutions and the destructive role that they play in a country's economy. Here's another example, describing this time, by an Australian journalist, writer, scholar, and documentary filmmaker. He, however, puts the blame on the U.S. He has said there are many examples of the United States using the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to shore up supports for foreign policy, naming the first Persian Gulf War as an example. In his undertaking of third world debt, taken up in his documentary War by Other Means, he revealed that the money owed to the rich world by the third world is far greater than the aid or charitable donations they receive. Pilger has stated that the multinationals' global domination demonstrates how the West has increased its stranglehold on poor countries by using the might of the IMF, World Bank, and World Trade Organization to control their economies. To conclude here, if you are in debt, stay away from these institutions. You may end up more than you bargained for. That does it for me.
My final thoughts, it's sad to see that Sri Lanka is giving the IMF serious thoughts for getting another loan, which at this point, it seems like they're going to go ahead with it. The IMF said it was very concerned about Sri Lanka's ongoing economic crisis and that it had started technical level engagements with the finance ministry and the central bank. What Sri Lanka needs to do, however, is to have some of its debt erased or refinanced, not to go to the IMF or the World Bank to have that refinanced. Because as we know, the debt spiral will come into play, and of course, it's the poor people who are going to get the short end of the stick. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. Please send us your comments and questions. We always appreciate them. For me, Kavita Lee, it's goodbye until next time.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين. Dear listeners, welcome to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program For Humanity. This is Sheikh Ali Hemani, and the segment is Hollywood, Conditioning of the Subconscious Mind and Extermination of Human Rights. So the whole discussion we were having so far was about Milgram's experiment and how an authoritative figure can dictate what needs to be done in your life. This would mean that the free will and the conscious decision-making that people have is being hampered and is being exterminated. And you would notice this in the current era. This Milgram's experiment and the outcome of it is extensively used in media. This is what we discussed earlier. But this is also used extensively by the political figures, the political bodies, or the politicians in the country, right? You would notice this in the current era of the vaccination, the COVID-19 vaccinations. So people wanted to have their say, their free will, their choice whether to get vaccinated or not to get vaccinated. But you would notice that politicians or the authoritative figures who are the doctors, could be the puppets of the government or, conducting independent research on the vaccinations. When they come around and tell the people that you need to get vaccinated to prevent yourself from falling sick, you would see that 80% to 90% of the people listen to them. Even they don't understand the side effects of the vaccine or the benefits of the vaccine. Just because an authoritative figure has told them to go get vaccinated, they go and get vaccinated. And then you will see that there are one category of people who wants to use their free will and say that we don't want to get vaccinated. So this Milgram's experiment gave a feedback, gave a finding in the hands of the media and the political world that they, being the authoritative figure, they can dictate their ideology, they can dictate their worldview, they can tell the people what to do and what not to do. Which also leads to the concept of mass control, that how the politicians and media uses these techniques to do mass control, to control the population of a whole country with the help of one single advertisement, with the help of one single message, with the help of one single movie. All right. Now, the big question that arises here is, why do they want to condition us? Why do they want to control us? Why do they want to take charge of our free will, and they want to decide for us? Because when this happens, when they are able to tell us what to do, what not to do, what to pick, what not to pick, then we become predictable for them. Because then they would know that how I'm going to behave when I wake up, how am I going to behave when I'm driving my car, how am I going to behave when I'm in the bank, how am I going to behave when I go to work, how am I going to behave when my child goes to school, when I'm left alone in the house, how my child is going to behave in the school, in the playgrounds, when he's playing ball with the with his team, when he's playing rugby or soccer with his team, and when he's attending classes, or even when he's out there shopping. So that would give them the level of predictability that would allow them to predict human behavior in different scenarios, in different places, with different age levels and different age limits. Inshallah, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and discuss this further.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about Milgram's experiment and how this experiment gives the power in the hands of media and politicians to dictate their ideology and worldview to people. And the question that was raised was that what's in it for them? What's their benefit to do this? And then we said that it gives them the predictability. It gives them the control. It gives them the ability to predict the behavior of people around them, that how people would behave when they go for shopping, how they would behave when they go to work, how they would behave when they're driving, so on and so forth. Now, when a person is predictable, then that gives you an upper hand on the person. It gives you that upper hand to be able to pre-plan the behavior of the person and then plan your next set of moves. This predictability gives both the authorities, media, politicians, and other authorities, the ability to maintain upper hand and maintain their level of power upon us, to enforce and exert their power upon us. Particularly the corporate world. Their focus is that when we can predict certain behavior of certain people, then we can make profit out of it. We can make money out of it. It gives us the power and authority. Look at Facebook, how Facebook profiles each member when they log in, when they register, and they update their data there, that how they wake up, where do they go for vacation, what coffee do they drink, what brand of clothes do they buy, where do they study, what college do they go to, where do they work. All this adds up, and Facebook is easily able to create a profile for you. And based on that profile, they also know how you're going to behave, how you're going to react to certain messages, how you're going to react to certain news, how you're going to react to certain actions taken by the government. And this allows them to take stronger, deeper decisions and control the mass behavior, control the people's behavior. And not just that, they use a technique called follow your favorite one. So what they do as part of their technique, for example, look at the Facebook, look at social media, look at TikTok, look at YouTube. What they do is they tell you to follow someone that you like. And on the other hand, there are these whole set of influencers that come in. If you look at the social media today, it's being ruled by the influencers. You've got hundreds and thousands of influencers making it big time on the media, on YouTube. Everyone, each of them having 60 million views, 65 million views, 100 million views, right? For example, Mr. Beast, right? In one of the interviews, I remember, he was being asked, how much money do you make every month from YouTube? And he said, I make $4 million from YouTube. And then he goes on to say that I spend $3 million in making videos, right? So that shows that the amount of effort, the amount of energy, and the amount of money that is being spent to make these videos, to influence, and that's why he's called influencer, to influence others. So that when he influences them, the media pays them. When he influences them, the corporate world pays him. So that he can continue to influence them, continue to tell them what to do, continue to tell them what not to do, continue to tell them how to live, what to pick, what to choose, what to wear, what not to wear, right? And this is what he's getting paid for. He is getting paid for promoting stuff that people are not in need of. So here's the set of influencers influencing us, telling us what to do, telling us what not to do. So this is where the Milgram experiment fits into the picture, that it gives certain power to these authoritative figures who come around and tell us what to do and what not to do. And these influencers are the ones who are dictating the terms to our youths and teens in today's world. Inshallah, we'll continue in the next episode. Until then, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على
محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.